You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, the CDC released a study that shows 1 in 8 deaths of working-age Americans are alcohol-related. A Wisconsin public health doctor joins us for a look at the problem and possible solutions. First, the U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments yesterday in a case that could change the way federal elections are conducted. Moore v. Harper is based on a once-obscure legal doctrine called independent state legislature theory, which argues that state legislatures can decide how federal elections are run in their state with effectively no in-state checks or balances. That means state legislatures can make their own rules for federal elections without oversight from state courts, governors, even their own state constitutions. We're talking about this U.S. Supreme Court case that could give state legislatures enormous power to regulate how elections for Congress, for president, are run in their states. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been following this case? What are your thoughts? Have you been seeing the headlines, wondering what's going on behind them? Do you think state legislatures should have more power in deciding how elections are administered? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Eric Casper is a professor of political science and director of the Menard Center for Constitutional Studies at the University of Wisconsin, Eau Claire. Eric, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with this case in particular. It's coming out of North Carolina. The legislature there passes their voting map, generally regarded as a gerrymander, in this case in favor of Republicans. The state Supreme Court says, hold on, this violates our free election clause in our state constitution. So here we are in the U.S. Supreme Court. How do we get from there to here?
Sure. Well, once the map was adopted by the legislature after the 2020 census, it was because of these concerns that existed by at least some state residents about there being a partisan gerrymander that they filed a lawsuit. And this is in part driven by the fact that in recent statewide elections in North Carolina, there's been pretty close to a 50-50 split in terms of voting, you know, between the two major parties. And the way the map was drawn, it would give the party controlling the legislature, they would be expected to win regularly 10 of the 14 congressional seats. So this leads to the lawsuit where, as you pointed out, the North Carolina Supreme Court interprets this provision in the state constitution saying all elections shall be free. And based on that, they say, well, this is too much of a partisan gerrymander, and they order the trial court to go back and to redraw the maps in a way that would be more even-handed. The trial court does that with the help of some elections experts. But then at that point, the state legislators who voted in favor of this map, they challenge what has been going on, and they asked the U.S. Supreme Court to review it, which is what they did in oral arguments yesterday.
And then here comes this independent state legislature theory, this idea. What is that? Where does it come from?
Sure. Well, the theory itself is that the Constitution provides state legislatures the sole power to regulate these federal elections, at least in certain ways. And there's some room for Congress here as well. But where states are to be involved, the independent state legislature says that it is the legislature itself that does this, and they cannot be constrained by other state actors, particularly state courts. The textual basis in the Constitution for this is a couple of provisions. The one that's most noteworthy in this case is in Article 1, Section 5 of the Constitution. It's called the Elections Clause. And it says that the times, places, and manner of holding elections for senators and representatives shall be prescribed in each state by the legislature thereof. Now, Congress also has some authority to impose some regulations as they relate to congressional elections. But when it comes to state powers on these types of issues, the text of Article 1, Section 5 says that it is the legislature, and the text specifies the legislature, not the state as a whole. So those adhering to the independent state legislature theory say that because of this clarity in the text, it means that these are state legislatures who have the power to do this, and they can't be constrained by other actors, including even state Supreme Courts, interpreting the powers that the state constitution puts in place for that state's legislature.
What has been the argument against that? And a lot of legal experts kind of across the political spectrum filed briefs arguing against that theory in this case. What are they saying?
Yeah, well, the just to kind of back up for a minute, I mean, the modern origins of this theory on the Supreme Court date back to Bush v. Gore in 2000, where it was not an opinion of the court where the justices stuck with this theory, but there was a concurring opinion by Chief Justice Rehnquist in that case, where he says, you know, as a general matter, it's respect for federalism that compels the Supreme Court to defer to decisions of state courts on issues of state law, but there are exceptions where the Constitution confers a particular power on a state's branch of government. And in this case, dealing with Bush v. Gore, which actually dealt with another provision in Article 2 dealing with appointing presidential electors, which gives that power also to state legislatures. But it's the same theory that this is something for the state and that for the state legislature and the state Supreme Court can't overturn that. Now, the other side of this is that the U.S. Supreme Court up to now has never, a majority of the justices have never adhered to this theory. In fact, there are cases which we can go into if you'd like, dating back 90 years where the Supreme Court has said, well, actually, state legislatures are bound by the terms of their own state constitutions, even with this protection for state legislative powers in the U.S. Constitution. And some of the arguments that came up in front of the Supreme Court yesterday dealt with some important questions relating not just to Supreme Court precedents, but also to separation of powers and checks and balances, which are, I mean, they raise real questions when it comes to the independent state legislature theory.
Talking to Eric Casper from UW-Eau Claire, political scientist there and expert on constitutional studies. Looking at this U.S. Supreme Court case yesterday on the independent state legislature theory, how much power state legislatures have when it comes to arranging federal elections, setting the rules for them, things like Congress and U.S. Senate in their own states. Do state courts, do state constitutions matter? Call 800-642-1234 with your reactions to this case, your questions, ruling not expected for some months on that. Let's go to your calls now. Lisa is with us in Madison. Lisa, hi.
Hi. I've been following this for quite some time now, and it's the whole thing flies in the face of the premise of our Constitution with checks and balances, and concentrating so much power into one body just undermines all of that. And then when you consider how many states have been heavily gerrymandered, including here in Wisconsin, we have basically concentration of power in the Republican Party, which would give them minority rule, you know, until who knows when. So the danger of this case is, I don't think it can be emphasized enough.
Lisa, thanks a lot for the call. A couple big things there, Eric. First of all, the checks and balances premise, that's what maybe we all remember from our civics or American government studies classes back in school. The idea that this particular power, at least at the state level, would have no checks and balances, the legislative body, or effectively no checks and balances, legislative body could set rules for this without the courts, without the governor stepping in. What do you think of her thoughts on that?
Yes, that was one of the things that was brought up during oral arguments yesterday by Justice Elena Kagan. In particular, this notion of checks and balances, and that we have understood that for a very long time as far as the concept of judicial review, to have courts have that authority to review the constitutionality of state legislative decisions in particular. And if you use this strict textualist interpretation that leads to the independent state legislature theory, it really calls that into question. And there's some concern with that as far as, you know, whether or not states in their legislatures would be able to do whatever they want. Some of those past Supreme Court cases where the court did not adopt the independent state legislature theory also speak to this. There was, for instance, a case that the Supreme Court decided in 1932, Smiley versus Holm, where the issue was the Minnesota legislature had put in place a congressional district map and the governor vetoed it. And the state legislature challenged it. And the Supreme Court 90 years ago says, well, even with what the elections clause says, a state legislature is bound by the terms of its own state constitution. And in Minnesota, like in other states, it gives the governor that veto power over state legislation. There was another much more recent case from 2015, which dealt with a ballot initiative that had been put on the referendum that had been put in front of the voters in Arizona to create an independent redistricting commission, basically to take this redistricting question out of the hands of the legislature, give it to an independent redistricting commission. This passed. The members of the legislature challenged this, but the Supreme Court said that even with the elections clause, it doesn't prohibit the voters, as long as they're exercising power that they're given by their state constitution, to be able to use this initiative process to create an independent redistricting commission. The only catch with that case is that that case involving Arizona in 2015 was a 5-4 decision in front of the U.S. Supreme Court. And we've had several changes in terms of the justices on the court since then. So we're not completely sure that this you would have a majority supporting that position today.
We're talking to UW-Eau Claire Professor of Political Science Eric Casper about this case, Moore versus Harper, the Supreme Court case heard yesterday that could give state legislatures almost unchecked power to regulate federal elections within their states. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think? What do you want to see from the Supreme Court when they rule in X number of months? Do you have questions about how this works, what it means? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Eric Casper, professor of political science at UW-Eau Claire, about a case heard by the U.S. Supreme Court yesterday about how much power state courts and state constitutions have when it comes to making federal election rules and the independent legislature theory. You can join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. Eric, before we go back to our callers, I want to talk a little bit about what's at stake. Critics of the independent legislature theory are painting a dire picture of what lawmakers could do with this power. What are some of the possible consequences if the Supreme Court agrees with the maximum incarnation of this idea?
Yeah, well, if the Supreme Court were to go all in, so to speak, on the independent legislature theory, and there's a possibility they could have a more measured decision, or there's a possibility they could reject it altogether. We kind of work through each of those if you want, but if they were to go all in on it, it could mean that state legislatures are basically immune from judicial review when it comes to within their own state systems, when it comes to federal election regulation. You think about that, that raises these real separation of powers and checks and balances questions. Depending on the state, there could be state constitutional provisions which are effectively nullified as they relate to elections because they couldn't be enforced in state courts against the will of the legislature. So if a state, for instance, has an independent redistricting commission, particularly if they established one through an initiative process, then that could be the end of that in some states. There are questions as they relate in particular to state versus federal elections, then, where you could effectively have two different types of elections that couldn't be on the same ballot because of the differences of how the state legislature might interpret the power it has over federal elections, but they wouldn't be able to do necessarily the same thing when it comes to regulating their state elections under their state constitution as interpreted by their state Supreme Court. And so that could lead to some messy situations potentially in terms of not being able to hold these state and federal elections at the same time. We might end up with more elections potentially. Now, if it were a more measured response, you could potentially have no change at all in terms of how these elections are being conducted currently. For some, that particularly, for instance, members of the North Carolina legislature, they see that as a problem, that at the moment it means that the state Supreme Court is able to take a rather vague provision in the state constitution and use it to limit the power of the state legislature. There were questions also raised at oral argument by some of the justices appeared to be more sympathetic to adopting this theory. Justice Samuel Alito, for instance, expressed concern about how state court judges are elected in almost every state. And so the way that things are going at the moment, if there isn't a change to that, it could mean that redistricting turns into more and more of a campaign issue for state Supreme Court justices, for instance, which could be inserting to a greater degree as we move forward, more of a legislative question into judicial campaigns. But again, the Supreme Court could ultimately take an approach that gives a little more federal court oversight to this process, while not adopting in whole the state legislative or this independent state legislative theory, which could be something of a middle ground, which it seems at least some of the justices yesterday were willing to entertain.
Let's go back to our callers now. Jeff is with us in Toma. Jeff, hi.
Hi. So it seems that the underlying facts of the legislative makeup versus statewide elections in South Carolina and Wisconsin share some similar characteristics. On statewide elections, Wisconsin has gone pretty much 50-50. On legislative makeup, though, you've got 70% Republican representation in both the state Senate and in the state assembly. Does any of this, or could any of this, have an impact on the way state legislatures take care of their own redistricting?
Oh, I gotcha, Jeff. Interesting question, Eric. As I understand it, the answer would be no, because state courts would and state constitutions would still have sway over the state legislative elections. Do I have that right?
At least with the issue being raised here, the independent state legislature theory, I mean, that relates to state legislatures and their ability to regulate these federal elections. Now, this, interestingly enough, this case and what's going on in North Carolina came before the U.S. Supreme Court a few years ago, and they were looking at this case, Rucho versus Common Cause, where the question was, well, does partisan gerrymandering as a general matter, is that something where the federal courts in particular can come in and do something about that? And the U.S. Supreme Court in that case ruled no, that there wasn't really a standard that the federal courts could apply to overturn partisan gerrymandering. And so that is, at least according to what we've seen in some recent U.S. Supreme Court decisions, something where they're saying, well, the federal courts in particular aren't going to tell state legislatures what to do when it comes to state legislative districts. But interestingly enough, even in that opinion, which was written by Chief Justice Roberts, he said that state constitutional provisions can provide standards and guidance for state courts to apply when it comes to these cases. So it's a long way of saying, number one, the U.S. Supreme Court is kind of deferring to state Supreme Courts when it comes to state legislative redistricting. And that's something that could ultimately be decided in a state Supreme Court. But secondly, even when it comes to drawing these districts in federal elections and for members of Congress, that case from just 3 years ago, the U.S. Supreme Court is at the very least implying that state courts have a role in that process. So at least at that point, we had a majority on the Supreme Court that wasn't adopting the independent state legislature theory. And again, Chief Justice Roberts wrote the opinion suggesting the direction he might go in this current case.
Jeff, thanks for that call. Leah joins us now in Ripon. Leah, hello.
Hi. I was wondering if you can shed some light on the historical context of this provision in the Constitution. It's easy to see how it could be abused if the Supreme Court rules in favor of the state legislatures. I'm wondering if there was a specific abuse that this was drafted to prevent, and if that is still relevant today. Thanks.
Yeah, and that's interesting. It's something that's come up a little bit in the briefs that have been submitted in this case, is that an earlier draft of the Constitution didn't specifically use the word legislature. And it just talked about states and their powers over these types of election regulations more generally. And that was then later changed to specify state legislatures. And it's not entirely clear what any purpose was behind tightening up that language, because it was during a process when a lot of things were being moved rather quickly. We have certainly records from the Federal Constitutional Convention that have survived today, but they didn't have someone there typing up every word that was said. And, you know, this is really relying on notes that were taken by the members who were there that they later, you know, had published. So it's not entirely clear why legislature was inserted into this provision and the other one governing electoral college selection in Article 2. It's something that in front of the U.S. Supreme Court, it hasn't been in front of the court as an issue very frequently. And the times where it has come up previously, at least, the majority has not signaled that this has the meaning that the North Carolina legislature wants the Supreme Court to adopt here. But again, that doesn't mean that they won't adopt that approach because this is really the first time this type of question has been squarely in front of the Supreme Court.
Well, and thanks for that call. And just our last minute, looking at the word legislature, it could mean, yeah, and just the legislature, nobody else gets to touch this. Or it could mean the legislature, of course, operating as in all things under its state law and its state constitution. How important a distinction is that, briefly, Eric?
Yeah, that was something that came before came up in oral arguments yesterday, kind of both sides of the coin on that. Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson making the argument that, well, when the Constitution uses the word state legislature, it's with the understanding that it's the legislature created by the state's constitution. And so the state legislature can't do something in violation of the state constitution. Interestingly enough, Justice Neil Gorsuch commented how that Smiley versus Holm case, for instance, which was the one from Minnesota in the 1930s, where the Supreme Court said that the governor had the power to veto this. He said that case doesn't really apply because he read legislative power, at least he was implying you could read legislative power to include the process of a governor vetoing legislation. And so he viewed that as part of the legislature and its processes and something fundamentally different from a state Supreme Court's ruling.
Eric, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Eric Casper, professor of political science, director of the Menard Center for Constitutional Studies at UW-Eau Claire. He talked to us about Moore v. Harper, the U.S. Supreme Court case heard yesterday that could give state legislatures almost unchecked power in deciding federal election rules. A ruling on that case, of course, probably months off now. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, WPR music host Lori Skelton shares some great classics for the holiday season, and you can join in with your own favorites. That's some music talk tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Have you had a moment of full-on slack this past year, binge-watching TV in your pajamas, eating dinner straight out of the can or the packet? Turns out you're not alone. You might be part of a trend that created the word of the year for 2022, according to the creators of the Oxford English Dictionary. The word, it's a phrase, really, goblin mode. That's goblin, as in the fantasy monster creature, not as in gobbling, but you could do that too. The slang term emerged online, apparently. Goblin mode is defined as, quote, a type of behavior which is unapologetically self-indulgent, lazy, slovenly, or greedy, typically in a way that rejects social norms or expectations. Apparently that's a thing these days. I used to be better at doing that. Now I have to take breaks from my slovenly behavior. That's one word. You can learn about more new words and phrases in the English language tomorrow at 3 here on Central Time. We'll look at some of the newest entries in the dictionaries this year and what gives words their staying power. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, 45 states and Washington, D.C. are reporting widespread flu activity. What can the nation do to stay safe over the holidays? 1A's series Vaccination Nation returns today to answer your questions. That's today at 6. Now, a new study by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention looks at the impact of alcohol on mortality in the United States. The annual death toll was in the range of 140,000. That comes from data before the COVID-19 pandemic when alcohol consumption went up. Two-thirds of those deaths are among working-age Americans between the ages of 20 and 64. That accounts for 1 out of every 8 deaths in that age range. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is alcohol abuse an issue that has affected you or someone close to you at your workplace and your family? How are you dealing with yourself? Do you have questions about the public health surrounding alcohol, what we could do to dial down this problem? Do you have thoughts on alcohol culture in the United States and here in Wisconsin in particular? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Patrick Remington is a professor emeritus in the Department of Population Health Sciences at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. He's director of the UW-Madison Preventive Medicine Residency Program. Dr. Remington, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be back. Thanks.
This is a trend, sadly, that you've been watching for quite some time now. These numbers, this is 2015 to 2019 data crunched here, confirm a lot of what we were seeing even before the pandemic, right?
Well, it does. We actually did a study very similar to this more than 20 years ago in Wisconsin, and the results were very similar. In that study, about 5% of all deaths in all ages were related to alcohol. And we don't like to say necessarily abuse, because sometimes a moderate alcohol consumption can increase the risk of a chronic disease, for example. And if many people are drinking alcohol moderately, then you can actually see a lot of disease and death related to what one might call normal use or not abuse of alcohol.
And this working age range, 1 in 8 deaths from 20 to 64, if you crunch it down to 20 and 34, I think it was 1 in 4 deaths. So these are ages that are less prone to die of some other causes. But what does that say to you, these numbers, when it comes to people in that 20 to 64 age range?
Well, it's a good point. I had always thought about all ages and that sort of 1 in 20 or 5% of deaths. But when you begin to narrow the age group to 20 to 64, working age, typical working age population, that percentage goes up to about 13%, even more in men. Men tend to drink more heavily and therefore have a higher proportion of disease caused by alcohol use. And then, as you point out, when you get to the ages of 20 to 40, for example, it's even a higher percentage. But again, as you mentioned, fortunately, relatively few people die under the age of 40. So although there are fewer deaths, more of them are due to alcohol, and most of them are due to what we call the acute effects, injuries related to motor vehicle crashes, even homicides and suicides. Alcohol contributes to those deaths. When you study a homicide, you find that many times the perpetrator or the victim have high blood alcohol levels, and therefore we posit that alcohol contributed to that event.
Talking to Dr. Patrick Remington, professor emeritus at the Department of Population Health Sciences at UW-Madison, looking at the latest CDC numbers on death related to alcohol. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions? Do you have solutions? Do you have thoughts on our public health approach to alcohol and the damage it can do? You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, questions, or experiences. That's 800-642-1234. Dr. Remington, as you mentioned, there are different things that go from alcohol to mortality. I want to talk about a few different ones and get into some possible public health approaches. One that we've talked about in the past is kind of a straight line from alcohol consumption to health problems that cause death. This is on my mind actually a lot in the last couple of years in my other life. I'm in the music community. There's a lot of drinking there. A couple of years ago, we lost a collaborator of mine in Wisconsin Rapids who died of an early dementia caused by alcohol. Just got word this week that a former bandmate lost his wife. Again, physical damage caused by chronic drinking. Can you talk about that as a cause of death, that excessive ongoing drinking, and what we can do to try to help people out of that?
Well, there's no question that what we call chronic heavy drinking is bad for your health. The liver is the organ most affected by this. And the leading causes of death in this study were liver disease, alcoholic liver disease, cirrhosis. And so that's the organ that really suffers the most with heavy alcohol consumption. And what does that mean, heavy alcohol consumption? Mm-hmm. Well, most people say that having more than 2 drinks a day three or four or five drinks every day for many years is heavy alcohol use. That might not constitute problem drinking because people may be able to function perfectly in society. So we wouldn't call that an alcoholic drinking pattern, but it is certainly bad for health. And these chronic diseases do accumulate, and there aren't very good treatments for the alcohol-induced liver disease, for example, heart disease, hypertension risk increases, and there are half a dozen or more cancers that are related to heavy alcohol use. So yes, heavy alcohol use, alcohol is a poison, and when taken in excess, it definitely affects the health and shortens one's life.
From a public health perspective, what do you see as the most effective means of outreach, prevention, to get the message out to people that that is a dangerous habit to have, and then to help them kick that habit?
Well, I think there are two approaches. One is individually. Everybody obviously needs to assess their own drinking behavior. Even more recently, a study just published last spring looked at light drinking. And we used to think that light drinking actually was good for your heart, a drink or maybe two a day. But the most recent research suggests that that's not, in fact, mm-hmm. the case. There's very little risk with a drink or so a day that has been shown in this research. But the more you drink, the greater the risk is. And so I think individually, we all have to self-monitor and think about our own risk. But the second area is what we can do as a community. For example, studies have shown that when you raise the tax on a product, fewer people consume that product. And so states and communities that have raised the excise tax on alcohol see less consumption. And that's been an approach that's been used widely, not just with alcohol, but with cigarettes, for example. The other issue is alcohol density. The more places that sell alcohol, the more hours, the higher the drinking patterns are. So that those are population-based or public health approaches that attempt to improve the health of everybody, not just individuals who have problem drinking.
And then, so I gave the example of chronic, long-term heavy drinking. Now, how about that acute instance? And we've talked about this before, too. Maybe it's binge drinking or somebody drinking more than they're used to. And as you mentioned, that could be connected to a homicide, a car crash, a fall, especially for seniors. How do we tackle that side of the problem?
Again, that's a very tough problem because those individuals who decide to drink, the term is binge drinking, where you drink maybe four or five drinks on one occasion, and then go out and drive a car or operate machinery or just fall. Those events are very predictable. We know from lots of research that people get impaired from even moderate drinking, and certainly binge drinking leads to an increase in risk. And so we've addressed this problem by having stiffer drunk driving laws and things like have a friend drive, where you may continue to drink, but you've decided to designate a driver in your group. So there are approaches, one of which is to avoid binge drinking, but the other is to avoid the activity that is dangerous when you've been binge drinking. And both of those have been successful. We've seen some evidence that car crashes related to alcohol use have decreased, but they're certainly not where they need to be. And there's a lot of more progress that could be made.
Talking to Dr. Patrick Remington, Professor Emeritus in the Department of Population Health Sciences and Director of the UW-Madison Preventive Medicine Residency Program, looking at the latest CDC numbers on deaths linked to alcohol in the United States. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We know these problems have been on the rise pre-pandemic. How did the pandemic impact alcohol use among you, your circle of family and friends? Do you see chronic heavy drinking in your community? Are there changes you think we need to make in our culture here in Wisconsin surrounding alcohol? Join in with your thoughts, questions, or experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our talk with Dr. Patrick Remington, Professor Emeritus in the Department of Population Health Sciences at UW-Madison, Director of the UW-Madison Preventive Medicine Residency Program, with us today to talk about the latest study looking at alcohol-related deaths among working-age Americans. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Have you changed the way you drink or whether you drink over time? How did it work for you? How has alcohol affected the health, your health in your family? Call in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Brian is with us in Madison. Brian, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I was just wondering if there is any data correlating income level with drinking, whether it's the risky drinking or just those long-term health effects. I know when I was in my young 20s, we couldn't afford to go out snowboarding or on a road trip, but we could split a 24-rack of PBR, and that's a good enough weekend. So I was just wondering if this affects people at lower incomes at higher rates.
Brian, thanks for the call. Dr. Remington, I know there are efforts to break things down demographically. Do we know if there's any link between income level and problem drinking or alcohol-induced mortality?
Well, again, this study did not look at that specifically. They looked more at the regional variation, and we see tremendous differences from state to state. Culture is a very big driver in alcohol use patterns and misuse patterns. And so that differs across all socioeconomic levels. And then the second thing is that the different causes of death are very different in different socioeconomic groups. For example, alcoholism and alcohol abuse is higher in people with who earn less money. Sometimes even the alcohol causes one to lose a job, and it's a spiral effect. But the binge drinking that you see, for example, drinking and driving, or even moderate heavy drinking, is not so strongly tied with economics. So it really requires you to tease out the specific causes of death and health problems, and so there isn't the association that you might see with cigarette smoking, for example, where rates of cigarette smoking are much higher in people with less education and people who are earning less. That alcohol related problems are less clearly related to those social economic factors.
Brian, thanks for that call and that question at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Lydia in Eau Claire. Lydia, what's on your mind?
Well, I'm interested in the idea of broadening, having people more aware that there are strategies to alcohol abuse beyond AA, because of course AA has done wonderful things for millions of people, but it also does not resonate with a lot of people who do have alcohol use disorder. And it's about curiosity around the whys of drinking and developing self-compassion. And of course, AA's peer group model, peer model, and sponsorship models to our genius, but I'm just saying that broader options besides AA.
Lydia, I got you. Thanks a lot for the call. Dr. Remington, is there a range of options for treatment, especially as Lydia was talking about, for people who would be seen as problem alcoholics?
Well, it's a great question. And as a preventive medicine physician, I truly believe that we should begin earlier, not just at younger ages, but earlier in problem drinking. That there are programs that are effective once somebody is affected by alcoholism and heavy drinking, but we have much more effective approaches that involve asking patients about their alcohol consumption and then giving brief advice about what might become a problem later on. So that brief counseling, how much are you drinking? Well, I hear you're drinking two drinks a day, every day. You know, that's a moderate level, and that pattern could lead to health problems down the road. It's much easier to intervene earlier in one's life and before problem drinking begins. So I couldn't agree more with the caller. We have to rely on those effective programs once people have suffered the consequences and become addicted or alcoholic, but it is much more effective to work earlier in the life and earlier in the problem drinking continuum.
Lydia, thanks a lot for that call. Dr. Remington, that kind of screening you just mentioned, screening and advice, is that common? Is that universal in doctor's appointments? Where are we with that?
Well, it's a great question. The research has been done. It's convincing. It's called screening and brief interventions and referral. So simply asking the question isn't good enough. But the evidence is very much there that if a physician or a healthcare provider asks you the question, has the conversation, that people open up and are often surprised to hear that even moderate drinking can lead to health problems. And then you refer to programs that can help people modify their drinking behaviors. Unfortunately, our healthcare system is not aligned as well as it could be to promote those effective preventive services. They don't get compensated very well. Health visits tend to be problem-oriented as opposed to prevention-oriented. So yes, they're effective. Some health systems implement them, but I think there's a lot more opportunity for doing that. Because again, prevention is the best medicine. And if we can intervene by having that conversation earlier, the changes are much easier for individuals to make.
Lydia, thanks again for that call. Talking to Dr. Patrick Remington about new data out from the CDC on alcohol-related deaths in the United States. Dr. Remington, you mentioned that they broke it down by region, and we can look at states from this report and, of course, from research you've done. What do we know about Wisconsin in particular?
It's a very interesting question, Rob. I immediately assumed Wisconsin would lead the list on deaths related to alcohol, but was surprised to see we are in about the middle. And then I recalled that we actually did a study about 20 years ago where, despite Wisconsin leading the nation in rates of drinking and binge drinking, we don't lead the nation in cirrhosis deaths. And what that means is that most likely in Wisconsin, we have a lot of people, a lot more people who drink, but we don't have, there's no evidence that I've seen of a higher rate of people who have problem drinking and diseases related to alcohol abuse and misuse. So that we have a high rate of participation in drinking, but many people drink light drinkers or moderate drinkers. So we don't certainly lead the list states that are seeing this. States like New Mexico, Alaska, Wyoming, those states have a much higher alcohol-related death rate than we do here in Wisconsin. Not that there isn't opportunity to improve. We certainly can reduce the alcohol-related deaths in our state, but we don't lead the nation in that measure.
And you've talked about a couple of the ways we can help reduce those numbers in Wisconsin or anywhere. How about culture and community and how we talk about drinking, how we drink, how we take care of each other when we're drinking to avoid those acute incidents, whether it's a car crash or a fall? Do you see room for improvement in Wisconsin on those measures?
Well, we know that one approach, prohibition, does not work. So I think any attempt to prohibit alcohol use is not going to be effective. I think certainly education early on about what is problem drinking, the difference between light and moderate drinking, heavy long-term drinking, and then acute alcohol use like binge drinking. So I think having conversations with your family members, your peers, but also the healthcare system does play a really important role in providing this kind of advice. Again, many people that I talk to don't realize that breast cancer, colon cancer, very common cancers that we certainly all want to avoid, are related to alcohol use. So when you look at a report like this, it is surprising how many chronic diseases, heart disease, stroke, liver disease, but also a number of cancers are related to moderate and heavy alcohol use. So I think that information alone can persuade some people. And then we have to come in with policies that have been shown to reduce alcohol use in addition to simply public education.
Dr. Remington, as always, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
That's Dr. Patrick Remington, Professor Emeritus in the Department of Population Health Sciences at UW-Madison and Director of the UW-Madison Preventive Medicine Residency Program. He joins us to talk about a new CDC study that shows 1 in 8 deaths among working-age Americans are alcohol-related. If you or someone you know needs help with alcohol abuse or addiction, you can contact 800-662-HELP. That's 800-662-4357. With the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration for referral and information services. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, find out why art can make a big difference in schools and not just in art or music classes. A guest makes the case that an art-inspired mindset can help kids learn all across the curriculum. And new words enter the English language all the time. Some of them even find their way into the dictionary after a while. Check out some of the newest words in the official English language, where they come from, what inspires them, and what helps some of them stand the test of time. And you can always follow us at WPR.org. Check out live streams and archives. That and more coming up tomorrow afternoon here on Central Time.